Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer. All lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I am with Andy Fisher. Just drink it in. Our favorite surgery resident / Facebook troll. How you doing?
I've gone from the patron saint of blood now to Facebook troll. That's good to know. I appreciate the introduction.
Yeah,
I
think. But that was almost the whole reason I reached out for you on this specific topic, because you made a post that was maybe a little bit inflammatory, and that we should be removing our needle D's from our IFACs. So since you can only write so many characters in a post, I thought I'd give you the chance to kind of quantify that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's frustrating, right? Is you can only write so many characters on Instagram, and you spend so much time trying to type it out initially, so 50, 2,000 characters, whatever they had their limit is, and then get it up. And by the time you're done, you're like, oh my goodness, I don't have time to write much more in regards to that. But no, you get. Well, honestly, so when you put together these posts, you do kind of have to formulate it, you know, in like a Word document or something like that, in order so you can fit all the characters in. But there's often many things that have to be left out because of that,
right?
Character limits and such. But anyways, the reason I say that is because needle D's weren't, or I guess just say decompression needles were never part of any sort of official like DOD IFAC packing list. I have looked all around and can't find any official packing list from any service, Army, Navy, Air Force that describes you putting a decompression needle as part of their packing list in an IFAC.
Right.
If we look back at what the initial intention of the IFAC, it was to basically the non-medical person who's most likely to be the person that responds to you can perform life-saving interventions. We initially put a chest seal in there, but we know that hemorrhage is by far the biggest cause of mortality out there. And so that's where the focus was, and it's appropriate that is mostly hemorrhage control. I think what happened is, you get these special operations communities that started putting these, decompression needles and such in these IFACs as part of like, hey, this is what I think we need. Then that kind of propagated along the lines to the conventional forces and to these, businesses that have, they make these IFAC refills and such. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think it probably went. I don't know for sure, but I'd be willing to bet that's probably about how it happened. I'm going to ask, have you ever seen an official IFAC packing list from the DOD that has a decompression needle on it?
No, I mean, just like you, we haven't found a, you know, official medic aid bag packing list either, you know? There's a lot of things that you should have, but it's all suggestion.
Mm-hmm. So look at the IFACs that were, you know, distributed by the Army before deployed and such. You know, they all had these list items in it. And I have found like an Army packing list, but I've never found any within a needle D. I have trouble finding one from the Marine, Navy, or Air Force.
Yeah. And I think a lot of guys, at least originally, before we had really pre-made stuff, was not only thinking about, you know, the non-medic being able to treat themselves, but also as a way to kind of spread the load as far as medical supplies. So things like needle Ds or chest seals winding up in an IFAC, even though maybe you wouldn't want your teammate to go ahead and do that on their own, but it's like their own little aid bag that I would co-treat them with as well, or extra supplies that I could treat somebody with.
So I can carry an entire platoon's worth of needle D or decompression needles in my pocket.
You sure?
I don't need someone else to carry them for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're literally, I can carry, it's about the size of a, you know, Coke can.
Yeah.
And circumference is about what I need for an entire platoon. So that's not a great argument. Second, you know, if I'm responding to someone, and I show up on a casualty, that IFAC, by the time I get to them, is probably going to look like a complete garbage trail of crap everywhere. And what's my success rate going to find that? Second, or I guess third one, it costs money. Like a lot of these units don't have a lot of class 8 money. So are they going to spend all that time trying to, you know, I put all these needle D's in these IFACs? That's a lot of money. And how many, like I said, how many of them are going to get lost then?
Right.
You know, not even in combat, like just how many are going to get lost just due to training or whatnot. And so I don't think it's a very great argument for having them in there. And also, you know, I think, you know, our discussion will eventually get to the point of like, how successful is decompression anyways?
Well, I mean, might as well jump into it now, because I think what ultimately should guide your packing list is what injuries, you know, do you suspect on the battlefield? And as I remember it correctly, tension pneumo, which is the whole point of having a needle decompression, was 2-3%. It was really small.
So if we're going off the Easter study, then it's 1.1. So there are 11 casualties that died from tension pneumo out of, 973 or whatever.
So, I mean, as far as training goes, you know, thoracic trauma is a major part of it, not just the hemorrhage control aspect of it, which can't really do a lot of it, but the management of chest trauma, be it hemothorax, pneumothorax, tension pneumothorax, all those things are just beaten into our heads. So I guess why, when it only happens 1.1% of the time?
I think people who may disagree with me would argue that, like, well, clearly that's needle decompression working. Mm-hmm. And so it's been done a lot. And so they were leaving the decompression or the tension. And therefore, that's why we don't have as many deaths due to it. The problem is that it's really hard to kind of identify those in the pre-hospital setting who have tension and where, you know, needle D didn't work or did work. You know, it's a very I'm not sure it's actually a great way to look at it from retrospective outside of looking at maybe some CTs. Now, that is a long, long process that I'm not even sure that we have probably the time or capability to even do. But we know that, yes, thoracic trauma is very common. It does happen. You know, how do people die in the pre-hospital setting, you know, from thoracic trauma? Is it bleeding? Is it tension? And I would probably venture to say that, you know, hemothorax is probably more prevalent of an issue than tension pneumothorax. And while it can be alleviated partially with a needle D for the tension wise, you know, you still have to do something about, you know, the bleeding that's going on. And so I think there's an issue there. I'm digressing a little bit, but I think the idea that, you know, we can simply address these or kind of identify these is challenging to the point where I'm not sure a great way to evaluate it. I know we just did a study on it that hasn't been published yet that talks about, you know, chest tubes being placed in the first 24 hours. And, you know, within that data set, if we look at the number of people that had a decompression in the pre-hospital setting, and I'll tell you the numbers, I think it's 124 people out of this data set that had decompressed by the in the pre-hospital setting. All right, so I apologize. Of 2,178 casualties who had a chest tube placed in the first 24 hours of arriving at a surgical facility in Iraq and Afghanistan, we saw 276 had a pre-hospital needle decompression. Interestingly, though, is we also had 130 had a pre-hospital chest tube. So 6%, half of those numbers, half that of the people also had a chest tube placed. So I wonder, you know, we don't have the number to say, hey, did the people who got a needle decompression also get a chest tube? Mm-hmm. I suspect that, yeah, if people got decompressed, there's probably a good correlation between that and the people who just simply got a chest tube placed in the pre-hospital right. setting. You know, you go back and forth a lot with people, you know, people who are a lot smarter than me, and we don't think there's probably a lot of deaths simply due to tension pneumothorax in the pre-hospital setting.
Is that because tension pneumo takes a longer time to develop than we give it credit for?
Yeah. So tension does, it does. Right. So what time does it take? You know, if you look at these studies for like chest seals and such, these are artificially created tension pneumos that they've created. How long does it really take? I think it varies on the injury mm-hmm. and overall other, you know, confounding variables that are hard to measure, but overall it probably takes a good amount of time for these things to develop, longer than most people suspect. You know, I think I have been in that realm of pre-hospital providers and combat, where, hey, someone gets injured, you show up, you throw in a chest seal, they complain of shortness of breath, you put a needle in them, and it, that's not the way it works. So, you know, I've long gone, learn from my past mistakes and understand that it's going to take a bit of time. Someone shot in the chest, of course they're going to feel probably some shortness of breath. Is that a great indicator that someone has tension pneumothorax? Probably not. And I think, you know, if you look at the TCCC changes that talk about tension pneumothorax and kind of working through a little bit more than, hey, they have a hole in the chest and they have a shortness of breath, you know, looking at more, hey, what do we have in for end-tidal CO2? Do we have any sort of hemodynamic changes and those sort of other more objective findings than just simply I feel short of breath and I have a hole in my chest as an indicator for tension.
Right. I mean, not to mention like some of the triggers that at least we've been taught, MOI plus one, right? He's got hit in the chest and he's got shortness of breath, regardless of the reason. Buys him a needle to the chest, at least.
Yeah. I think, I guess my problem with that they've been trying to argue against it, some people surprisingly don't like, is I'm like, combat medics are smarter than this. You guys have the ability to assess and do a little bit better job and use objective data to help drive your management. And, you know, a lot of people see it as me trying to take away skills. I'm just trying to argue that medics are smart and they have the ability to, you know, make decisive and important decisions based upon objective data at the time. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want them to use. And I want them to be able to use their skill sets appropriately and not just randomly throw stuff out there. And and just apply it like, decompression needles and IFAX. Like, what does that really do for anyone? I don't think it does anything. So again, I think it's, medically smart, and they have the ability to do a great job if we give them the tools.
Right. Plus, I think the way we set up training, everything is, we need to hurry up. We have to go through 10 iterations today, or we need to, we cram training in. So
that probably has a lot to do with it, right? Yeah. We like, hey, well, we only have, all right. You show up and, we only have 10 minutes for this iteration. So we're going to work through a, massive bleeding airway. Then we're going to get to respiration. So I'm going to have to work that in. So it's going to have to be pretty quick here. So I'm going to have to kind of develop this casualty in a situation that you're going to decompress within probably the first 5 or 10 minutes.
Right. And I mean, you have medics that their certifications are kind of on the line. So they have no choice but to come up with shortcuts in order to get ahead of the instructor.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole gamut of issues that way beyond the topic of this discussion, right. But it's very true. Yeah. I mean, we've recently, probably saw the article that, John and McCarthy, Mike Laurie and I wrote about, training and for pre-hospital trauma and how people use these unorthodox ways and try to pray really kind of, I think, try to create these stressful situations that aren't necessarily appropriate and don't do any benefit to the trainee. Anyways, beyond this talk.
Of course. And, maybe we need to do ones more specific to that. But I would say this for just my own little feedback is reality is stressful enough. You do not have to add anything. It's just giving honest vitals, honest signs and symptoms can stress anybody out. I see that a lot. Even when given extra resources, guys really want to put all their weight on MOI plus one. I'm not wrong. Even when it's like, well, you have an ultrasound right there. Why don't you just scan his chest quick and put this thing to bed?
Yeah.
But
yes, I agree.
So, and I 100% agree as far as the speed that a pneumo will transition into a tension pneumo is really unknowable. I think it's obviously going to vary with the injury. It's going to vary with the respiratory rate. It's going to, is the guy receiving positive pressure ventilations? There's a bunch of variables to that. Yeah. However, how about this? How much of the lung can collapse or be collapsed before you actually see any real signs and symptoms? If that makes sense, because, you get a 10 cc pneumo, he's not going to have, his SpO2 start falling. He's probably not going to really have real difficulty breathing. I think some of our assessment ideas like IAPP is, I think you're fooling yourself if you can say, I'll auscultate a pneumothorax or I'm going to percuss one.
Some different studies out there that look at, how many centimeters on radiography, on X-ray, right? Is it stable where you can just like pull a chest tube and such. And I think it's like, 25 millimeters maybe, and I hope none of your listeners actually take for what I'm saying right now is truth. But there's some sort of range in there. If I remember right, about somewhere around 25 millimeters or something like that. Which is, 2.5 centimeters, which is about an inch. Mm-hmm. We pulled chest tubes on people in the hospital, that have a sort of, that sort of amount of chest, or I should say a pneumothorax. Mm-hmm. Now that's after they've been on like water seal. So you put the chest tube on water seal for like 24 hours. There's no increase of the size of it. And so you're kind of looking like, hey, you know, this looks pretty stable. You know, can we pull this chest tube and at least get him mobilizing and probably end up having that chest or that pneumothorax reabsorbed and, you know, re-expansion of the lung. And then there's the argument like, hey, do we end up having to redo chest x-rays every time someone has a, you know, you pull a chest tube? And honestly, like, you know, trying to identify and, you know, which, sorry, can That's we right. go, can we stop and recut that?
Okay.
Sorry, man.
But I'm I guess what I'm down
the pathway that I was trying to think of, and then I ended
That's up, all right. I've been drinking too. So
I'm drinking the afternoon.
But
or drink in the afternoon.
I guess what I was looking at is like, you know, does it take just a little bit of air? It takes a fairly large amount of air to actually cause signs and symptoms.
Yeah. I'm going to give you, I wish, you know what, do you have, when you post this?
Sure.
So I wonder if it would be important to maybe post a picture of that. And because you can still see the lung is up. And I'm not sure exactly if there's any data to say, hey, how much of it is going to have, is going to be up before you can, or down before you actually will create tension.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even just a change in vitals.
Yeah, that's what's most important. It's not necessarily about, hey, how much lung is up, how much lung is down, because it really has nothing to do with the actual lung being up or down. It has to do, tension with thorax is a cardiovascular issue. It's not a respiratory issue. And I think that's the problem is we're looking at is a lot of people think of it like, hey, let me evaluate, you know, how much lung is up, how much lung is down. Do they actually have a pneumothorax? It doesn't really matter. What matters most is like, what are your hemodynamic changes and are they causing my patient to go into cardiovascular collapse? And I need to do something about it now. Right. That is the crux of it all.
No, that makes 100%. But if you're seeing any kind of hemodynamic change because of that, you are way behind the power curve. Like you should have been paying attention long before this.
Well, if you're going to place a chest tube, sure. But that's the problem is like people think, well, I need to get ahead of attention. Well, no, you can't get ahead of attention. We do these life-saving interventions like needle decompression because there is a life-threatening condition. Yes. You are not going to get ahead of anything if you're not going to put a needle into a pneumothorax and think you're going to not then, oh, my patient's not going to get attention now. That's not going to happen. The tension either presents itself or it doesn't.
Okay.
And if you start seeing hemodynamic changes that represents a tension pneumothorax, then you do the intervention.
Right.
So yeah, I disagree with you that the idea that we can't, that you can somehow get ahead of it. I don't think you can. You see hemodynamic changes, you make an intervention, and there you go. And that's what we do in medicine, right? We don't prophylactically do a whole lot of life-saving stuff, right?
Understood.
You kind of wait for something to present itself, and then we do the intervention.
But I mean, we do chest tubes, I mean, before they become tensions in hospital. They're like, this person is sats are dropping, and maybe he's not hemodynamically affected, but we know that this is happening based on chest x-rays or whatever.
We do chest tubes because they have increased oxygen requirements. They are hemodynamically unstable. Well, if they're hemodynamically unstable, they're not getting a chest tube. They'll probably get a simple thoracostomy and then transition to a chest tube. They get chest tubes because they may go to surgery for, you know, maybe get a VATS. But chest tubes aren't necessarily life-saving, or it's not like a life-saving intervention per se. you know, we do chest tubes for a lot of reasons, but in the big scheme of things, you know, we've moved away from thinking of them as like life-saving interventions per se to doing something like simple thoracostomies where you have to vent the chest.
Yeah.
And that's life-saving. But yes, eventually they need to have some sort of, you know, a tube placed. And, you know, there we can kind of look at, hey, okay, is there a air process to this? Is there a blood process to this? Or is it a combination of both? Many times a combination of both. And what we do is we simply can measure the blood output and determine if it's a massive hemothorax or if it's something that can, okay, it's kind of dwindled off. We don't need to do much about it. We can then measure things like, you know, H and H's and such to determine if they need a blood transfusion. But, and you know, if it's a tension pneumothorax that we leave, then awesome. Now we have, they still have to have a chest tube placed because of the basis of the, you know, the physiology of the chest that is works off negative pressure.
Yes.
Right. So we have to be able to then recreate that with a chest tube and to place it on negative or place it to suction. And hopefully the lung re-expands on its own and they can then have it pulled after a couple of days and they can go home.
Right. I mean, I definitely see your point as far as it not being an immediate action drill as far as the chest tube goes or a finger thor. Absolutely. Maybe a needle decompression, which to be honest, I've been starting to think lately, why don't we just do finger thors? Because they work very well on both air or blood versus, a needle only really works well for air in my experience.
And that's where I have now kind of evolved to.
Okay.
I used to think that a simple thoracostomy was not something that should be done on a regular basis in the pre-hospital setting. I still don't think it should be done on a regular basis. I think it should be done for those in the, you know, who present with true tension physiology. And maybe that's why I've evolved to this. My current thought process is that it's probably the best is I think we do way too many needle decompressions. Mm-hmm. And so if people look at it like, we can stick a needle in. And even if they didn't have if they had a pneumothorax and okay, it's not going to do much for it. If I stick a needle in and they didn't have one, then, it's not going to be a big pneumothorax or whatever. But the decision to, you know, make a few centimeter incision in someone's chest wall is completely different than, you know, putting a needle in. And I think it's far more effective when in terms of alleviating the tension or, you know, evacuating the blood, which, as you can say, a needle's not going to do anything with.
We kind of talked about pneumothoraces developing into tension, right? What about hemothoraces developing into tension?
Yeah. Yeah, dude, I'm taking you down a pathway of, I don't even know where we're headed at this point, but
yeah, it's okay.
All right. I hope the listeners get a good laugh at listening to me just talk. And go down random pathways. So can blood create tension? I think it can. I think if you look at, you know, again, this is a cardiovascular issue. And what really creates tension, as we describe it, is, you know, decreasing blood return to the heart. So crushing basically those soft pliable vessels in the mediastinum, namely the vena cava. You know, central venous pressure is pretty darn low. And what blood is put, you know, what the left ventricle pushes out is obviously we know is, you know, systemic blood pressure for the most part is much greater. And so can blood then accumulate to the point that it can, you know, push on this vena cava? I believe it could. And also if you talk about the fact that, you know, we're in a confined space of the chest wall, or I'm sorry, not the chest wall, but in this, you know, the hemidiaphragms.
Yeah.
It isn't like your left and right and mediastinum, they're all connected. They're all kind of separated.
Yes.
So yes, in my hemithorax, is completely separated from the other hemithorax.
Yes.
And so if I, that's a confined space. So if I push blood into that, am I able to create enough pressure against the vena cava to cause a tension? I think there is, I think it's very plausible. Mm-hmm. But I will say also that the amount of blood that each hemithorax can hold is almost enough to kill a person.
Yes.
So at the same time, is it plausible? Yeah. What are the chances that person will be living?
Right.
At that point, I think is also questionable.
I think it's a lot more plausible when you start including blood transfusions.
Yeah.
That's why I think you have, if you have chest trauma that you do now have hemodynamic effects, you need to start blood and then you need to start evacuating that chest.
Yeah. 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 So, and then you can talk about, hey, well, do we reuse that blood? Which I don't think you should, I don't think it's a wise idea to reuse that blood. I know they've, that's been a previous, I think, probably discussion, in the PFC community.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's plausible. It could happen. I don't think it's very likely. I think there's probably a large air component to that that would also cause that tension physiology. It's very rare to find it'd be very rare to find a just straight hemo portion to a thorax.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I didn't just say it's rare. I just think it's probably uncommon. I think there's probably some sort of parenchymal lung injury can occur with a lot of these injuries that end up causing air leaking into that space to also kind of create the tension physiology. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't want a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me commenting and saying that I'm full of crap. So I'll revise that statement to say that there's probably a large portion that also have a parenchymal lung injury associated.
Yeah, that's very safe. I mean, I think people get a little bit too worried about saying their an opinion. And it's like the disclaimer says in the beginning, it's just somebody's opinion, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I know. It's certainly at this point, I should probably know a little more than.
That's why we're all learning, right?
But so what else is out there?
I mean, those are the main things. I think guys have very little patience for the intervention that they do. So they'll drop a needle and then it's like, nope, didn't work. They wait 4 seconds and then they pull it back out again.
Yeah.
But I think, again, I think it's more of a training thing. We're just cramming pathology into a very confined space and we're expecting immediate results and we get, pneumonics or just trains of thought that allow us to operate in that environment versus having kind of the patience for the pathology to understand, well, if it didn't develop in 10 minutes, it doesn't mean anything. It can develop whenever it wants to. And you have to be constantly aware.
I'll say that massive hemothorax is more prevalent in the last 20 years versus tension pneumothorax as far as it's causing death. Another interesting facts: if you look at thoracic trauma, obviously is very common. I'm just going to tell you some information that may be useful to your listeners. Up to 49% of casualties end up with a chest tube in combat. So roughly half. That's pretty significant. Yeah.
Does that mean I should just put them in the field?
Oh, absolutely. No. All right. See, massive hemothorax, 1,500 milliliters at once. Or
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Milliliters out for 2 to 4 hours, you know.
Okay. Does that really change, I guess, your thought process or, treatment plans as far as, hey, this is a massive versus this is not a massive?
So, you know, when you look at things like ATLS, you know, these are decisions to take people to surgery, yeah. Right? So how does it impact what we do in the pre-hospital setting? You know, should you triage someone at a higher level if they have that output? Well, you've already put a chest tube in, like you're already that concerned. So that's not really going to change their triage status, right? They're right. Still going to be pretty high. Sure. Like, get this guy out of here. I think what's important, about, you know, monitoring that is just, yeah. Hey, knowing how much is coming out is very important. Hmm. And then being able to replace that and looking at hemodynamic changes and knowing that this patient probably is going to require some sort of surgery is important, right? Mm-hmm. It's doesn't necessarily change a lot what you can do from in the pre-hospital setting outside of doing transfusions, but it just allows, I think, you to have a better idea of what's going to happen and how do we, you know, just understand. I think the big picture, I think, is critical also. And I think it's often not explained to, you know, the medics and such who don't really know, hey, what happens after I drop my patient off? Well, we look at a lot of different things in order to determine if, you know, patients need to go to surgery versus being, can they be monitored? And a lot of times, you know, things like hemothoraxes, that's where we kind of look at, does someone need to go to surgery? Are they hemodynamically unstable? And, you know, you look at things like dysregulated tension, pneumothorax, by itself isn't that really a reason to go to surgery. They just get a chest tube and a lot of times they get it observed. Mm-hmm. Versus, if you're bleeding, then it has, you know, sometimes it has to go in and you have to control that.
Understood.
There are occasions, you know, when people have, they have parenchymal lung injuries and you have to go in and maybe do like a little, you do have to resect some and you had to go and do surgery because it's a persistent issue. But that's, you know, that's way down the line. Mm-hmm. Typically, you know, you observe people for a few days if they have just a simple pneumothorax due to some sort of penetrating injury.
Right. So Andy, you're king for a day. You get to change the face of T-tri-C and combat medicine and the DOD. What would you change as far as treatments for chest injuries?
I don't think chest seals do a lot, but I will leave them in play for now because they're not currently a skill for the all service member. Mm-hmm. So I'll leave that in play. I would move simple thoracostomy to... Clearly, I'd move it up and make that more of a primary treatment versus needle decompression. Clearly, if you have someone who is in hemodynamically unstable, they need a simple thoracostomy versus a needle decompression.
Yep. Understood.
I think that's what I would do. There are a lot of people who clearly who disagree, and that's fine. I think there are arguments to be made on both sides. But I do think that we need to kind of make that a more definitive primary treatment. We make it a more primary treatment, which is a more moving towards a definitive sort of treatment, sort of algorithm versus trying to just get away with doing simple needle thoracostomy.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, to be honest, just watching in training and having done, you know, some anyway, I'm starting to think that the simple thoracotomy is actually safer than the needle D.
I think so. I think there's also some things we'll go with that. Yeah, I think it's, you know, look at where we're placing these needle Ds. They've been placed in hearts. They've been placed in you know, big vessels and such. You know, maybe they're trying to alleviate that. I think that's part of the, you know, the reason they went to, you know, go to fifth intercostal space for a needle D. But yeah, you kind of, it's, there are pros and cons to each. People put chest tubes in below the diaphragm all the time. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't say all the time. It happens. And it's not a fun process going through that. But at the same time, if you clear your space appropriately with your finger, you should be good to go. Yeah. And yeah, you cut down, basically simply just cut down to the skin, cut down to the rib, go right over the top of that rib, go in, feel around, and you should be good.
Yep.
And there's a clear, it's not always a clear evacuation of air or blood. Some of that can be a little bit loculated. And so you really do have to run your finger up and down and around to make sure you're clearing the blood and air. I've seen a loculated tension, if you can imagine that, to where someone did a simple thoracostomy and went in and just kind of made the incisions, kind of stuck their finger in like, oh, okay, I'm in. And the attending then came in, and because I was on one side and the resident was on the other with the attending, and he stuck his finger in, is like, no. And you could see this big rush of air or feet, you know, there's a big rush of air that came out. Yeah. You could hear it.
So loculated means just trapped.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's trapped somehow. Maybe it's trapped by blood. Maybe it's trapped by, you know, maybe some of the other tissues around there, like the lung or whatever.
Yeah. So you're presenting to SOMA or would like to present to SOMSA. So what do you want to talk about?
So I want to talk about, you know, basically our findings with this chest tubes in the first 24 hours of arriving at a combat surgical facility, cache or whatever we're calling it now, hospital center or whatever, wherever a surgeon is who can do surgery. But also talk about, you know, hey, is there a better way to kind of identify more treatments outside of the hospital, you know, and what can we do with that? Unfortunately, there's not a lot of great correlation between what happened. You know, we did see a small number of patients that had needle Ds, a small number of patients had chest tubes. It's this challenging area because it really is, you would think being able to look back, we'd have that sort of correlation a little bit better aligned, but we just don't. I still think that looking at the number of patients that ended up with chest tubes in the first 24 hours, that maybe something like simple thoracoscopy may be a better option. I still believe that. Certainly I have, John Matha, who, you know, is leading the current review of chest trauma for COTSI, I added him as an author because I really kind of wanted to get his input on it and where we're going with this. So he, you know, he's part of the author list here. Very important person to kind of have his input, but we'll see. You know, I don't want to divulge everything, but right. Yeah.
Has that paper been published yet or?
Not published.
Not published. All right. Still secret. All right.
It's not secret. I gave you some numbers. I can't give you everything though.
Why not? It's a PFC podcast. I'm trying to do my best here to help everybody out. Help a brother out.
I gave you the nuts and bolts of probably simple thoracostomy is probably a better option for people in the kind of that peri-death, right? Yeah. They're not dead, but they are getting close. Right. So someone arrives and, I mean, you got to get the blood out anyways.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
No, we also were supposed to talk about the study out of Tucson.
Yeah.
About pigtails versus chest.
Oh, Jesus, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've been hearing a fair amount since this last study about, you know, pigtails and how it's as effective as chest tubes. Is that something that we should be doing in the field?
I feel far more comfortable with, one, if you don't have radiography, I don't think so. Like, I can do a chest tube and place it and feel it is in the chest with a high degree of overall confidence versus this. So, you know, chest tube, I'm feeling inside the chest wall. And I'm placing that chest tube against the chest wall. Pigtail, I'm like, you know, I get it. It's like, it's much better for, I shouldn't say much better. It may be better in some situations for patients. You know, it's percutaneous. You make a small little neck. You do it Selinger technique. You know, you kind of have to go with the needle to aspirate some air. And then you kind of pass the wire. And then you end up, you know, dilating and placing the pigtail.
Right. Yeah, initially I thought it was, because I'd never done one before, I thought it'd be like putting in a needle D. It is not at all.
Yep. No, not at all. I'm a surgical resident, and I will be happy to say that I have messed these up on more than one occasion. And I say surgical resident in that I hopefully gives me a little bit of leeway to mess up.
Right.
You know, no patient was permanently injured. There's nothing like that, but you know, you have to go back and redo it. Mm-hmm. You know, so there, I don't think a pigtail is something that should be done in the pre-hospital setting, unless you have some sort of radiography.
Okay.
So if you can take a chest X-ray, I can see that. Yeah.
But I mean, to be honest, as far as reliability, I mean, yes, the pigtail was shown to be able to drain blood or mm-hmm. fluid. But people forget that blood clots, and once blood clots, it's not going through that pigtail.
Yeah. And So what are you going to do to alleviate that? Right. You're going to put in like some, you're going to flush it. Sometimes that works. So you're like a, you know, a little, I don't know, some sort of TPA or, you know, something to kind of break that clot up, which isn't really, I mean, you do that right. With, you know, big empyemas and stuff, right? We put, you know, the clot busting stuff into the chest, but one, it's expensive. Two, who's going to carry that in the pre-hospital setting?
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of stuff to go along with it. You know, if you have radiography and you have the ability to really monitor your patient closely, I think I don't think it would be terrible. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's something that like, hey, I'm going to do this instead of a chest tube in this austere setting.
Right. No, I think the juice is, to me, the juice is not worth the squeeze. I can put that chest tube in and, you know, this, just watching the procedure of doing a pigtail, it did not look like that was going to happen. You know, I'm familiar with it. I've been training with this, with the chest tube for a number of years. Yep. I know it. I'm good at it. And I'm just not seeing a great benefit of changing what I got right now.
I don't see the benefit on, yeah, that PCC, PFC side. Now, you know, you talk about in a more, you do transition more of that PCC, which I still will contend is battalion aid station care, mm-hmm. you know, could you have some sort of radiography there? Sure. I think you could do that. Could you use some sort of other imaging that could definitively tell you you're in the chest, great. Maybe that's the way to go. I just don't see it in a, like a PFC. And that sounds weird, right? So we're doing a more probably invasive procedure in this more austere, dirty setting. But I think, it goes back to the number of steps, the ability to confirm and placement and such. And you just need, you definitely need to have some sort of imaging for, I think, a pigtail placement.
Yep. I think you're right. Not to mention, I mean, I think the whole purpose is that it's a more comfortable for the patient. I got drugs for that, man.
Yeah, it's definitely more comfortable with the patient. And, you know, and while I try not to delineate between pre-hospital care and what happens in the hospital too much, I think in this sort of situation, it's like, okay, they can wait to in the hospital if they want to do something that's more comfortable for the patient. This is, something that needs to be done in a austere setting. And, you know, again, we have drugs for that.
Yep, that's right. Thank you again, Andy. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, man.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Every boy is waiting there for you.